This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, Managing Editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Tomorrow is the 75th anniversary of the D-Day invasion. We're going to start the program by talking about how important it is that we exercise our imaginations to bring history like that to life, and what happens when we don't. And at the end of the program, I'll talk about a haunting trip I took, not to Normandy, but to another World War II battleground. We'll also hear a report from trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about a tiny group of islands in the middle of the Indian Ocean that may be changing possession. This is a story that doesn't get a lot of attention, but we're watching it because it would fulfill a specific biblical prophecy. Then we'll talk about the challenges facing America's farmers and food producers. Trumpet writer Andrew Miller has a report about how they're up against the twofold crises of weather disasters and trade war, and he links those to prophecies of food shortages facing our nation. We'll begin, though, by talking about war. Tomorrow is the 75th anniversary of D-Day. Two summers ago, I was able to visit Normandy and the American beaches, Utah and Omaha. Visiting those beaches and the cemetery that overlooks them was one of the most moving experiences of my life. That history feels distant and sterile, like it may as well be from ancient China, until you find a way to project yourself into it with an act of imagination. Seeing those sites firsthand definitely jolted my imagination. To see the bunkers those soldiers faced, the sands they stormed, the cliffs they scaled, the land they liberated, is awe-inspiring and humbling. These sites resonate with the history of men. The great mass of them peers to the boys filling our colleges today who faced death and spilled blood for no less a cause than to save civilization as we know it. The operation on June 6, 1944 was incomprehensibly massive. Over 156,000 Canadian, British, and American men flew nearly 15,000 sorties, dropped 7 million pounds of bombs, and piloted nearly 7,000 vessels in the largest one-day amphibious invasion in history. These young men traveled to that remote shore, swallowing their fear, weapons in hand, summoning the willingness to kill and to be killed to liberate a people they had never met. By day's end, that beachhead that led to Allied victory in World War II was firmly established. 20,000 vehicles had been landed along with nearly all the soldiers. But in the process, in that single savage day, 5,500 Allied men had been wounded or gone missing, and over 4,500 had been killed. And they were among an even larger number who traveled to Europe to liberate the continent from Nazi tyranny and who never left. Today, 9,386 American men and women remain near Omaha Beach, entombed at the American Cemetery in Colville-sur-Mer. Canadians buried their dead at Beni-sur-Mer. The British at Bayeux. To stand in a green field among thousands of white stone monuments, standing in perfect attentive formation, like the soldiers over whose bodies they lie, bearing dates of death mostly clustered around a few blood-soaked months in 1944, is emotionally overwhelming. These individuals were willing to do whatever was needed to get the job done. Had they not been prepared to give their lives, the flame of freedom in Europe would have remained extinguished, as it had been for the years before that invasion. Driving through the coastal towns, you still see signs proclaiming France's gratitude to America and Britain and Canada for sending their sons to fight and die to set them free. The fact that this took place 75 years ago means that only the ancient retain this history firsthand in memory. There are a few men in their 90s yet alive who stormed those beaches. But for most of us, it takes an act of imagination. For most of us, our world is so far removed from the noise and the clamor of war. Our wars are fought by professionals on small scales in obscure theaters. For most people, it's a hum in the background. It's easy to ignore. And this gives us the luxury to devote our attention to other concerns and to fight far pettier battles. Society is fighting for the right to be referred to by pronouns of our choosing, fighting to create safe spaces on college campuses, fighting to undermine the president and remove him from office if possible. This is what happens when actual war and the prospect of war is so far removed from people's thoughts and imaginations that it is inconceivable. What's the biggest threat to our planet that we keep hearing about? Climate change. We have to stop carbon emissions. The window is closing on our opportunity. This is our generation's World War II, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez says. Several of the Democratic presidential candidates say climate change is their primary political concern. A Harvard Public Opinion Project survey showed more than 70% of young people belonging to Generation Z worry about climate change. Two-thirds of them say it is a crisis that demands urgent attention. We must prevent our planet from perishing in a climate change-induced apocalypse. This idea is being promoted loudly and emotionally and incessantly. This is the battle today's younger generations in particular want to fight. It was just 14 months after D-Day that America took a drastic step to bring the war in the Pacific to a swift conclusion, targeting the Japanese city of Hiroshima with a nuclear weapon. And 3 days later came Nagasaki. This was nearly 74 years ago. Again, this is beyond living memory of 93% of the people alive on Earth today. The rest of us have to imagine a city being hit with a nuclear strike. And most of us simply don't make the effort to do so, especially since the end of the Cold War. The risk of nuclear war has almost disappeared from the public's mind. But the reality is that since those two detonations, the number of nuclear weapons has multiplied. The number of countries possessing nuclear weapons is far higher, and the destructive power of nuclear weapons has increased exponentially. The Global Challenges Foundation says nations today possess 15,350 nuclear weapons. It says right now, 4,000 of these weapons are in active deployment, meaning that they are available for use at any time. A nuclear war could be just moments away. In recent years, more and more nations have been working to build nuclear weapons or to improve their nuclear arsenals, to make them more accurate, more deployable, more destructive, more lethal. Last year, Russia unveiled its Satan II missile, the largest ballistic missile in history. Each missile can carry 10 large nuclear warheads or 16 smaller warheads, practically enough to destroy an entire European nation or a U.S. state as large as Texas. Bloomberg had an article May 15th titled, "Nuclear War is Still Very Possible and very scary. It says, we should be worried, very worried indeed about nuclear weapons. They are becoming easier and cheaper to build, and it is not implausible to think that nations such as Iran, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia might get them in the next 20 years to the detriment of regional stability. And 20 years is a very conservative estimate. Iran is working very diligently to get nuclear weapons. Saudi Arabia is working on nuclear power plants. And it says if Iran gets the bomb, it would respond by getting one as quickly as possible. This article continues, North Korea keeps adding to its stockpile of nuclear weapons and improving the quality of its delivery systems. Meanwhile, a generation of hypersonic delivery systems being developed by China, Russia, and the U.S. will shorten the response time available to political and military leaders to minutes. These hypersonic missiles travel three times faster than the world's fastest bullet, and they're maneuverable. So there is no missile defense system in existence today that can stop these missiles. This article continues, that raises the risk of false signal turning into a decision to retaliate, or it may induce a nation to think that a successful first strike is possible. Remember, it's not enough for the principle of mutual assured destruction to be generally true. It has to be always true. You also have Germany and Japan, the Axis powers of World War II, for whom any discussion of nuclear weapons has been taboo for decades, both of these nations openly discussing acquiring nukes. And these are two of the greatest industrial powers in the world. Now, how is it that the reality of these threats would be ignored? That people would dismiss nuclear war as simply being a threat of the past? And that they would fixate so much on climate change, a threat far more distant and remote, if it's a threat at all. But that is what they're exercising their imaginations on. They've allowed the lessons of history to fade. They've forgotten the realities of war and its destructiveness and its suddenness and its savagery. And they're imagining a threat that barely exists. It reminds me of a poem by Billy Collins about the importance of history and the dangers of forgetting it. It's called The History Teacher, and it's comical, but it makes a very important point. Trying to protect his students' innocence, he told them the Ice Age was really just the Chilly Age, a period of a million years where everyone had to wear sweaters. And the Stone Age became the Gravel Age, named after the long driveways of the time. The Spanish Inquisition was nothing more than an outbreak of questions such as, how far is it from here to Madrid? What do you call the matador's hat? The War of the Roses took place in a garden, and the Enola Gay dropped one tiny atom on Japan. The children would leave his classroom for the playground and torment the weak and the smart, mussing up their hair and breaking their glasses, while he gathered his notes and walked home past the flower beds and white picket fences, wondering if they would believe that soldiers in the Boer War told long rambling stories designed to make the enemy nod off. It isn't too far from the kind of history our teachers are giving the next generation, except they're managing to fill them with hatred toward their own country and their own heritage. And today's students are acting out like those kids on the playground, bullying others, breaking their glasses, convinced of their own superiority to all others, certainly to past generations. They alone understand the real threats to the world. They alone are responsible enough to demand change and to save the world. But very soon, reality will intrude. the true threats facing our world will begin to erupt into actual disasters and shatter illusions. The Bible prophesies that Europe is about to be swallowed in tyranny again, one even more barbaric and oppressive than that of World War II. But at that time, a generation of young Americans and British and Canadians rose up to defend Western civilization at the greatest cost they could pay. In these end-time prophecies, there's not a word about any resistance coming from these countries. In fact, these nations are explicitly counted among the victims of that empire that dominates the continent. An empire that, just as in World Wars I and II, is a German-led European empire. Looking at our nations, particularly in contrast to what they were at the time of the last World War, it's not difficult to see why. As a generation ignores actual threats to our civilization and fights on the phony battlefronts of transgender rights, racist police, carbon-induced climatic disasters. The Bible is also clear that nuclear war is coming. Jeremiah 2:15 talks about cities being burned without inhabitant. Habakkuk 3 describes plants that don't blossom or give fruit, fields that produce no food, stocks of animals wiped out. And it says that it's the work of invading soldiers. Amos 5 describes an attack that destroys 90% of a city's population. The Outrider Foundation says that only 115 kiloton bombs out of the current global stockpile of almost 15,000 nuclear weapons needs to detonate in order to create nuclear winter and make life on Earth uninhabitable. In Matthew 24, Jesus Christ prophesied, "For then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be. And except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved. Not one person on earth would live." That time is coming. Those nuclear weapons will be used, and the signs Christ gave of when this warfare will break out are being fulfilled right now. You can read about these in Gerald Fleury's booklet, Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door. It's available for free at thetrumpet.com. It takes an act of imagination to recognize the seriousness of these warnings, but it's critical that we do so. As Isaiah 33 and verse 18 says, "Your heart shall meditate terror." Gerald Fleury wrote, "God says to meditate on the terror to come. We must face it. If we don't face it, we become susceptible to deception and complacency and other nation-destroying problems." Thankfully, the same scriptures that foretell these disasters also show that they are mile markers on the path to a glorious future. That same verse in Matthew 24 finishes by stating that those days shall be shortened. God will not allow mankind to destroy itself. And every one of those prophets who forecast this destruction also described the hope that lies beyond. Amos 9 describes Israel rebuilding the cities destroyed in war. It says that people will have so much abundance they can't gather all the food in fast enough. Jeremiah says that despite all the trouble, there is hope in your end. "They shall all know me from the least of them unto the greatest of them," says the Lord. It says in Jeremiah 31. Habakkuk writes of a time when the earth shall be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Eternal as the waters cover the sea. That is a marvelous future. But we can't overlook what's going to come before that. Take time to think back on our history and exercise your imagination to see similar events playing out in the near future, just as the Bible prophesies.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
In the middle of the Indian Ocean is a small group of islands with tremendous strategic importance for Britain and America. The United Nations is applying pressure for these nations to give the islands up, as we will now hear in this report from Jeremiah Jacques.
Before World War II, Great Britain and the United States came to control an astounding number of the world's important maritime passages and ports. They controlled the Suez Canal, the Panama Canal, Singapore, Cyprus, Hong Kong, the Cape of Good Hope, Sri Lanka, Gibraltar, the Chagos Archipelago, and several others. America and Britain's control over these strategic locations played a key role in decades of global stability and economic growth. That's largely because around 90% of the world's trade travels by ocean. So with the US and Britain keeping these routes and choke points navigable, global commerce was able to flourish. The US and Britain's control of these locations was also indispensable to Allied success during World War II, and to other conflicts that they've taken part in. But since the end of World War II, America and Britain have surrendered control over almost all of these assets. They've handed them over, one by one. And last month, the United Nations said one of Britain's last few foreign maritime gates, the Chagos Islands, must now also be surrendered. The Chagos Islands isn't a place that makes its way into the headlines very often. It's a small archipelago about 1,000 miles south of the southern tip of India. But it's been under Britain's control since 1814, after the UK took it over as part of the Treaty of Paris, following the defeat of Napoleon Bonaparte. For the first century and a half, Britain governed the Chagos Islands from Mauritius, which was also a British colony at the time. But in 1965, Britain made the decision to administratively detach the Chagos Islands from Mauritius. A short time later, Mauritius became independent, and Britain retained possession of the Chagos Islands by paying Mauritius the modern equivalent of about $35 million. A big part of this money was paid to relocate the Chagos Islands' entire population, which was only about 1,500 people, off of the islands. In his book, Colonialism, an International Social, Cultural, and Political Encyclopedia, Carl Hack writes about what Britain accomplished by relocating the population off of the island. He writes, quote, "In this way, Britain secured a staging post in the mid-Indian Ocean to project military power eastward, one that, unlike populated colonies, could not demand independence." End quote. The British understood that the location of Chagos Islands gave them great strategic value, and they decided to share this value with a trusted ally. In the late 1960s, the UK signed an agreement with the United States, allowing American forces to use the Chagos Islands, and they built a joint US-UK military base on the largest island, which is called Diego Garcia. In the 60-plus years since then, the UK, and even more so the US, have maintained a military presence on the Chagos Islands, and they've used that presence to stabilize that part of the world and to project power in the area. And it's played a surprisingly big role in US military power especially. GlobalSecurity.org wrote about this recently, explaining that along with Guam, the Diego Garcia base offers military planners the ability to project air power to any crisis location in Southeast or Southwest Asia. And more importantly, it provides the U.S. the ability to arrive at those locations quickly. A publication called Strategic Analysis also wrote about the value of this location to the U.S. military, saying, quote, "Diego Garcia facilitates U.S. power projection through long-range bomber operations, the replenishment of naval surface combatants, and the strike and special operations capabilities of guided missile submarines that can call at the Atoll's wharf." End quote. The Chagos base is home to more than 1,000 U.S. soldiers and staff, and has been used by the Navy, the Air Force, and even NASA. It played a major role in the U.S.'s operations for Operation Desert Storm, Operation Desert Fox, Operation Enduring Freedom, and others. And it's also been vital to America's fight against piracy in the Indian Ocean. That's a fight that the whole world benefits from. Analysts say that for all these reasons, Diego Garcia in the Chagos Islands has become one of the U.S.'s most important and most secretive overseas assets. So the importance of the Chagos Islands to the U.S. and U.K. and to general global security is beyond doubt. But America and Britain's presence there may now soon be coming to an end. Back on February 25th, the UN's International Court of Justice ruled that when Britain separated Chagos from Mauritius in 1965, it was a, quote, unlawful detachment and a wrongful act. The official ruling said, quote, the UK has an obligation to bring an end to its administration of the Chagos Archipelago as rapidly as possible, end quote. So this is not really at all surprising, coming from the UN's International Court of Justice, since the organization has a track record of very often siding against the UK and the US. And it was also not really surprising on May 22nd, when the UN's General Assembly took that same stance, voting overwhelmingly to condemn Britain and the US's use of the islands. That vote was 116 voting against, and just six nations, including the US and the UK themselves, voting in favor of it. So that's quite an overwhelming vote. The court's ruling was only advisory, and the UN resolution was non-binding, so it is possible that Britain and the US will not immediately cave in to this pressure. But it does indicate the decline of the US and Britain's diplomatic power, and it also takes on great significance when viewed through the lens of Bible prophecy. The Bible specifically discusses strategic maritime choke points, passages, and ports, such as the Chagos Islands. It calls them gates because these locations give whoever controls them strategic access and a level of control over the surrounding areas that is of great value. And these kinds of gates are mentioned in Genesis 22, verse 17. In this passage, God makes a promise to the patriarch Abraham that his descendants would one day, quote, take possession of the gates of their enemies, end quote. That's the International Standard Version of the verse there, and this is talking about maritime gates. The late educator, Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong, proved this in his book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. And he also proved that the peoples of the modern U.S. and Britain are the very descendants of Abraham who received this promised possession of sea gates. Abraham's great-grandson was Joseph. And Mr. Armstrong wrote about Joseph's two sons, who were named Ephraim and Manasseh, and he proved how the families of these two men expanded and grew and became modern Britain and America. And he wrote, quote, the descendants of Joseph became numerous and encircled the globe and came to possess the gates of enemy nations. Britain and America came into possession of every such major gate in this world, end quote. Based on Genesis 22:17, Mr. Armstrong said the fact that the U.S. and the U.K. acquired these strategic oceanic locations around the world proves that these two nations are the descendants of Abraham's family and of his grandson Israel. He wrote that having had possession of those gates shows that the U.S. and U.K., quote, must be modern Israel, end quote. Britain and the U.S. coming to possess all those gates was a stunning fulfillment of Bible prophecy, and the Bible also prophesied that the U.S. and U.K. would later lose control of those vital sea gates. In Deuteronomy 28:52, God says that if the descendants of Abraham reject him, he would cause their enemies to take control of those gates. It says, the enemies of Britain and the U.S. will, quote, besiege you in all your gates throughout all your land, which the Lord your God has given you, end quote. Mr. Armstrong proved that this was a prophecy, that America and Britain would lose control of these sea gates. And throughout Mr. Armstrong's many years of writing and teaching, he witnessed the UK's loss of control over many of these locations. There was the Suez Canal, which Britain lost control of in 1956. Then there was Singapore, Cyprus, the Cape of Good Hope, and several others. And based on this prophecy, in Deuteronomy 28:52, Mr. Armstrong forecast that the trend would only accelerate. In the 1980 version of the United States and Britain in Prophecy, he wrote, quote, "As the pride of our power continues to be broken, as the British continue to lose their foreign sea gates and possessions around the earth, as America signs away ownership of the Panama Canal, this focal prophecy alone represents giant proof as to where the modern remnant of the peoples of Israel resides today." End quote. When Mr. Armstrong died in 1986, the U.S. still controlled the Panama Canal, even though Washington had begun to sign its ownership away. And when he died, Britain still controlled Hong Kong. But since his death, both of those incredibly vital locations have been surrendered. At present, Britain still controls a handful of foreign sea gates, including Gibraltar, the Falkland Islands, and the Chagos Archipelago. But the UN's resolution on May 22nd shows that the pressure on Britain to surrender Chagos is rapidly building, and indicates that the loss of those other remaining locations may not be far behind. Mr. Armstrong taught that the U.S. and U.K. losing control of foreign sea gates shows that the world is hurtling toward a time of catastrophe and suffering for the American and British peoples and for all nations. But he emphasized that the suffering has a godly purpose. That purpose is to teach the nations that their attempts to rule over themselves without God only end in tragedy. The purpose is to teach them to love God's law in his way of life. Mr. Armstrong also emphasized that the age of unprecedented suffering that is now fast approaching will be quickly replaced by an era of unprecedented peace. One final quote from his book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, says, "The prophecies do not stop with the revealing the unprecedented multiplied intensity of punishment already beginning to descend upon America and Britain. The prophecies record also the result of that intensified punishment. The result will be a corrected people. The result will be an eye-opening realization of what we've done to ourselves. The supreme punishment will teach us at last our lesson. The punishment will break our spirit of rebellion. It will lift us up from the cesspool of rottenness and evil into which we've sunk. It will teach us the way to glorious peace, prosperity, and abundant well-being. On beyond the frightful national calamities now descending upon us will come a blessing inconceivably greater." To learn more about the very detailed Bible prophecies that Mr. Armstrong relied on to make his accurate forecasts, and to learn about the hope that is really at the heart of these prophecies, please order your free copy of his book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
America's food production is being imperiled both by recent weather disasters and by trade policies that are drying up foreign markets. We'll learn about how this could contribute to fulfilling some alarming biblical prophecy in this report from Andrew Miller.
Across the American Midwest, farmers are going bankrupt. Last year, Nebraska grain farmer Kirk Dusing filed for bankruptcy after 4 decades of farming. Year after year of low corn and soybean prices left him with too many bills he just could not pay. So Dusing sold land and equipment to raise emergency funds, but it was not enough. He was still more than $1 million in debt. So now he's bankrupt and making ends meet by planting crops for other farmers. Nationwide, most farms lost money last year. In the Midwest, 230 farmers went bankrupt, twice as many as did during the Great Recession of 2008. These bankruptcies are the result of a prolonged slump in grain prices caused by rising competition from nations like Brazil and Russia. The woes faced by farmers have been compounded by China's tariffs on soybeans, Mexico's tariffs on cheese, and the catastrophic flooding that's taken place across America's Midwest. At a time when U.S. farmers are being battered by foreign competition, large swaths of nine major grain-producing states have been flooded. This flooding has washed away huge tracts of corn, soybeans, and other crops. Calves, chickens, hogs, and other livestock are being wiped out, and the average farm income has halved from its peak in 2013. This means America's farming industry debt-to-income ratio is higher now than it has been in a generation. The average farmer actually has six times as much debt as the income they make in a year. Farmers are facing the worst economic crisis since the 1980s, and it stands to intensify. Bumper crops of Brazilian soybeans and Russian wheat are expected to keep grain prices low, while flooded fields are making it impossible for American farmers to plant those crops anyway. Over half the nation's fields have not been planted as of last week. Many farmers are thinking about just skipping a year and making a government insurance claim. But even if the weather improves in 2020, crop prices will still be low, and the soil in America's fields may be ruined. In an interview with The Trumpet, Colleen Rambo, who's been working for a disaster response team in Nebraska, related, "The croplands have been covered with sand. It felt like I was in the Florida beaches. One of the farmers was telling me that this happened back in the 1950s, and they turned over the land 5 feet in order to bury the sand. And they can't do that again because it will just bring the old sand back up." So there are millions of acres that are not going to be planted this year. The amount of food that is going to be produced in the Midwest is going to be dramatically reduced. Millennia ago, the Bible foretold that an agriculture disaster would plague America in the end time. Bible prophecies in the books of Deuteronomy, Isaiah, and Ezekiel indicate that foreign nations like Russia, China, and Japan will join forces to shut the U.S. out of more and more markets. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry explains in his book Ezekiel, the End Time Prophet, "As the U.S. and Britain become less and less competitive worldwide, unemployment will steadily increase. The fact that the U.S. and Britain have lost control of the world's most important strategic sea gates like Panama, Gibraltar, Suez, and Singapore will make it much easier for foreign nations to choke off these nations' supply lines." Bible prophecies in Deuteronomy 28:52 state that nations of end-time Israel will lose these sea gates as they turn away from God. The United States and Britain are going to be left out in the cold as two gigantic trade blocs, Europe and Asia, mesh together and begin calling the shots in world trade. Meanwhile, a sobering prophecy in the book of Joel shows that America's fields will not yield their increase. The first chapter of Joel says, "Be you ashamed, O ye husbandmen, howl, O you wine dressers, for the wheat and the barley, because the harvest of the field is perished." These prophecies are now in the early stages of being fulfilled. Foreign powers are cutting American farmers out of more and more markets, and U.S. fields are not yielding their increase. Ezekiel's prophecy indicates it will get so bad that a third part of the nation will be destroyed with pestilence and with famine. And while it definitely takes a large measure of faith to believe things will get this bad, there is already abundant evidence that the worst agricultural disaster in U.S. history is fast approaching.
Thank you for that, Andrew. Those prophecies about Israel you were getting into at the end there, obviously we have a lot of proof that those apply to modern-day America. Jeremiah was even talking about that in the previous segment. But you were talking about a proof that is specific to America's agriculture, pinning it to those prophecies.
Yeah, that is a fascinating question, because actually the amount of grain being produced in the Great Plains is actually a proof that America is end time Israel. The late Herbert W. Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain and Prophecy, gets into that. But it basically focuses on a prophecy in Ezekiel where God's telling Israel that if you turn away from my laws and disobey my statutes, I'll punish you seven times more for your sins. And in the Bible, a time is a year, and specifically a prophetic time is a 360-day year. And so you have 360 days in a year times 7 years. That's 2,520 days. Also, students of Bible prophecy will know that there's like a day for a year principle, where God oftentimes uses a day to represent a year. So he's talking about 2,520 years of punishment. And you know from history that the Assyrians took over the northern nation of Israel, and they left the southern nation of Judah, but they took over the northern nation of Israel in the year 718 BC. So if you count 2,520 years from 718 BC, you come to 1803 AD, which is the exact year that Thomas Jefferson purchased half the North American continent for 5 cents an acre, this Louisiana Purchase, the Great Plains. It's actually the Great Plains. It's an amazing geographical feature. And it's the world's largest continuous area of arable farmland. Not only is it the world's largest continuous area of arable farmland, it's also between the Ohio River, Missouri River, and Mississippi River. The entire thing's interconnected by the world's longest navigable river system coming down to the port of New Orleans. And so that was obviously a great thing for America when he bought that, but it literally changed the world, because you had this huge expanse of farmland with farmers producing not only enough food to feed their family, but like surplus food that they could export down the Mississippi River. They actually said they exported so much grain to the eastern United States and to England that the farmers in the eastern United States, the Atlantic coast of the United States and England, they didn't have to farm anymore, because the Midwestern farmers were feeding their own families and the world. And so all you had like these farmers across New England and Old England who got jobs in factories and basically kickstarted the Industrial Revolution. And then between the surplus agricultural production and the surplus factory production, the money basically financed the nation building of the United States. Georgia A Friedman from Geopolitical Futures makes that point, that he said America's political system was founded in Philadelphia, but it was New Orleans and the Louisiana Purchase that produced the wealth that built the nation and made America a superpower. And so after that 2,520 years of punishment, God made America a superpower by giving them the Great Plains and the grain it could produce.
That's fascinating history and really inspiring as well. Herbert W. Armstrong covers some of that in the United States and Britain and Prophecy, drawing attention to the Louisiana Purchase specifically, but to think of it in terms of just how much it benefited the nation's wealth is quite fascinating. So, you know, the idea of us having food shortages and famine, I think it's very difficult for Americans to imagine that. Our food production has been very plentiful. There are very few Americans who aren't, going back to Great Depression era who've experienced anything like the kind of deprivation on the scale of what those prophecies are describing. But there are, I guess, our whole food production industry is quite susceptible to disruption in a lot of ways. I think these weather disasters show just how much things can change within a very short period. A couple of bad harvests and you have problems, these trade wars that you're talking about. Maybe you could just talk about some of the other vulnerabilities that our food production has to disruption.
Right, because now famine in general, there's two causes for pretty much any famine. You either have like what you'd call a natural cause or a man-made cause. Now the book of Joel is very much focusing on like natural or like God sent curses, droughts, floods, crop failures. But the book of Ezekiel indicates there's a very strong man-made element of this too. And in the editor-in-chief, Fleury's booklet, the Ezekiel booklet, actually makes the point that it links the words pestilence and famine. But the word pestilence carries a very strong connotation of like civil unrest, civil war, urban rioting, supply lines being disrupted that intensifies the natural disasters America's experiencing. Probably one of the biggest ways you could see that, like urban unrest or supply lines being disrupted, contributing to famine is artificial fertilizers. It's been said that when Thomas Jefferson bought the Louisiana Purchase, they said the amount of organic content in the soil was close to 5%. So some of the richest soil on earth. That soil's been way worn out. Now they said it's probably the average organic content in this area is down around 2%, which most soil scientists would tell you mean that you should be getting toward like borderline desert once you hit 2%. Now the main reason the Great Plains is not a desert is because they America will produce nitrogen fertilizers from natural gas and spread that on the land. So that way you're actually, the plants are growing, are taking nitrogen that's been artificially knifed into the ground, and the dirt's basically just something for the roots to hold on to keep the corn stalks upright. But the thing is, those nitrogen fertilizers, first of all, actually I think probably close to half of America's nitrogen fertilizers are produced in Russia, Ukraine, and Tobago cumulatively. The other half we probably produce domestically. But like I said, if you're talking about like a trade siege where if Tobago, Ukraine, or Russia decide to stop selling us nitrogen fertilizers, or if urban and civil unrest in the United States disrupts the supply lines of those nitrogen fertilizers so you can't get that to the farmland, even without flooding or drought, your crop yields are going to drop by more than half just by the fact that there's no nitrogen left in the soil. It's been worn out after 150 years of farming.
Yeah. Well, it is a fascinating subject, and I think it's one that will impact every American at some point in the future. It's something that we need to look at those prophecies and make sure that we're taking those warnings very seriously. We appreciate that. We've been talking to trumpet writer Andrew Miller about the crises facing America's farmers and food disruption. Disruption of our food production in the future that is prophesied in the Bible. He's working on an article on the subject for the next print edition of the Trumpet magazine. You can watch for that in the coming weeks. Thank you very much, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
It's time for today's last word.
It jarred me the way those hulking relics of war stood starkly against the tropical foliage. Demolished, pockmarked concrete, surrounded by beautiful, lush green plants. This is Corregidor, Island of Antithesis. This small island fortress in the Philippines was the setting of some of the most dramatic scenes of World War II. It simultaneously symbolizes bravery and betrayal, humanity and hatred, strength and savagery. Gazing across the scene, I was bombarded by incongruous images and emotions. But the biggest collision in my mind was between the epic past and the uncertain present. After it captured the island from Spain in 1898, the United States built a major military outpost on Corregidor. The Rock bristled with guns and mortars, a total of 23 separate batteries. Yet Corregidor was also a soldier's paradise, with a sandy beach, golf course, baseball diamond, opulent cinema, lavish officers' quarters, and excellent barracks, housing thousands of men, all against a backdrop of the calm waters of Manila Bay. Most of these impressive installations are still there, but now they are skeletons, bearing the garish scars of the horrors they endured. Of those enormous barracks filled with soldiers, only empty concrete shells remain, interlaced with rebar that holds sagging chunks of staircases and walls aloft in twisted formations. Gaping holes and mounds of rubble mutely testify to the furious Japanese aerial bombardment. The theater is roofless and hollow. The swimming pool is a cavity carpeted with vegetation. The ruins still reverberate with the voices of the soldiers who occupied these structures, who manned these munitions. Every blast hole brings to mind the men whose bodies were also blasted and battered when the bombs fell. Buried in the center of the island lies Malinta Tunnel, a colossal bunker complex that the Americans drilled into a mountain over the course of a decade. The wide but dank passage now serves as the setting for an audiovisual show telling the story of its construction and use during the war, MacArthur turning it into the USAFFE headquarters, the Philippine government taking refuge there, and the unfolding of the most shameful chapter in America's World War II history, the betrayal in the Pacific. 10 days after attacking Pearl Harbor, the Japanese descended on the Philippines, America's possession. President Franklin Roosevelt immediately proclaimed his, quote, solemn pledge, backed by the entire resources in men and materials of the United States, that America would come and safeguard the Filipinos' freedom. MacArthur skillfully evaded Japan's powerful clutches, evacuating U.S. and Filipino forces to Corregidor to make a stand until reinforcements arrived. But the solemn pledge was a blatant lie. The help never came. Allied forces on Corregidor eventually succumbed to Japanese butchery and surrendered on May 6, 1942. The presentation well conveys the terror of those days, with sounds of enemy planes buzzing outside, of bombings that shook the tunnels, of the voice of President Quezon lamenting, "How typical of America to writhe in anguish at the fate of a distant cousin, Europe, while a daughter, the Philippines, is being raped in the back room." Then the radio announcement from the Voice of Freedom. Despite the Allied forces' superhuman endurance in the face of overwhelming odds, Bataan has fallen. But the spirit that made it stand, a beacon to all liberty-loving peoples in the world, cannot fall. It was galvanizing, yet gut-wrenching to hear, knowing the hellish death march those captured soldiers afterward endured. The next wave, I felt, was one of redemption, hearing how America partially atoned for its treachery when it fought back for the Rock 3 years later. On the island's topside hill is a field too small for an airborne combat landing zone, yet this is where hundreds of daring men parachuted down from just 400 feet, descending directly into a cauldron of fierce close-range warfare. These tough men, who knew both the nobility of sacrifice and the brutality of killing, were the liberators of Corregidor. A short walk away is the Pacific War Memorial Museum. There I stared at the black and white portraits of the officers who had orchestrated the offensives and commanded the troops. They seemed like superior men, serious, manly, steely, intelligent, men of character, men who inspired men. I felt small. I tried to comprehend this conflicted past. These ruins impressed me with what the men did here, yet I could not escape the whole truth. Like every battlefield, this was just another horrid chapter in human war making, another place where high rhetoric clashes with the low things human beings do to each other. These ruins are oddly relevant to the present. Their hollowed hulks evoke the decline of America. As Moses prophesied long ago, the pride of its power has been broken and lies in rubble. Only the facades remain. 3 generations after what proved to be America's last unequivocal military victory, the U.S. presence in the Philippines is only an echo. America's reputation is mortally wounded. Its ambition has shrunk. Its unprecedentedly superior military is oddly impotent against the most pitiful of threats. It all makes Scripture's most shocking prophecy seem far more conceivable. When the next world war breaks out, America will shrink all the more, and horror will spread over the globe virtually unchecked. I walked beyond the Memorial Museum to a rotunda. There I saw words chiseled in stone that finally reminded me of hope. Sleep, my sons, your duty done, for freedom's light has come. Sleep in the silent depths of the sea, or in your bed of hallowed sod, until you hear at dawn the low, clear reveille of God. I look forward to meeting them when that dawn comes. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that is it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on the program today to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Jeremiah Jacques and Andrew Miller. Thanks to Jesse Hester for engineering and production. And I'll leave you with this thought from Albert Einstein. I know not with what weapons World War III will be fought, but World War IV will be fought with sticks and stones. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.